It is the getaway afternoon version of the Federal News Countdown, and my guests in studio, having chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week and ready to count them down with you on the Federal News Countdown, are Gordon Adams of American University and the Stimson Center. Gordon, it's great to see you here today.
Great to be here.
And Greg Garcia of Garcia Cyber Partners. It's also good to see you, my friend. And we have two new folks on the Federal News Countdown this week, so I promise that I'll go slow, but I think you've got the hang of it, both of you. We start, as we always do, with the third most important federal news story of the week.
Number three!
As selected by Gordon Adams, it's from the New York Times. It's Jonathan Wiseman's piece titled, Talks to Avert a Fiscal Crisis in the Fall End with No Result. And, Gordon, this is, I guess, surprising on the one hand, and totally not surprising on the other hand. Is that fair to say?
There's a reason why the New York Times buried this on page A486. It's because there is no news here, but you still have to write the story. The budget talks begin to feel like Groundhog Day all over again.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another round of getting the wrong people together in the room with some of the right people on the administration side, but not having anything to talk about. So they spent 2 weeks with people like Bob Corker and John McCain and folks like that saying, maybe we can find the edge of a budget deal here. No deal. There was never going to be a deal. And frankly, the wrong people were in the room. Where were the appropriators? Where were the budget committee chair and ranking member? Where was the majority leader? Where was the minority leader? They weren't in these discussions, and it was very clear from the start this just wasn't going to advance the game. So we're going to have a very interesting fall.
This struck me as a math problem, too, as much as an attendance problem. I agree with you on the attendance problem, but it was a math problem, too, because if you're not going to have the people in the room that you were talking about, then you needed to have about six or eight more Republicans to be able to get the Democrats to 60.
You need six or eight more Republicans from the Senate, and of course,
yes,
at some point,
yes,
you got to do something about John Boehner. And John Boehner's problem is he doesn't really control his caucus on this subject. He has got a significant and, I think, frankly, growing minority right now who really are prepared to go to the edge of the cliff, who really want to have the money for next year in a continuing resolution be the same as the post-sequester money for this year.
Mm-hmm.
And there are even some who want the number in the continuing resolution for discretionary spending to be $967 billion, which is what would happen after sequester next year.
Yeah.
So the pressure is really on Boehner here, and whether he can or even wants to come up against the net to try to deliver his caucus for any kind of a budget deal. I don't see it. I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Now, Bloomberg reported today that the Republicans in the House are preparing a $988 billion CR, but that's assuming that that's the leadership. You were talking about what some of the really aggressive budget hawks want to do with that 967 number, and it doesn't sound like it's that big of a difference, but it's a huge difference as far as trying to get a deal done amongst the factors that are involved there.
It is an enormous difference. It's almost a gulf of a difference between the two sides. And it's not clear the Republicans will come together, and it's not at all clear that any of the Democrats want to agree to that. And the problem is when you get a deal of any kind of deal, because of Boehner's problem with his caucus, he really at the end has to do what he did in January of this year, which is reach over to Nancy Pelosi and say, can you deliver me enough Democrats?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll deliver you 90, 100, 110 Republicans, and we'll get some kind of a short-term deal through. All of this says the politics of getting a big deal are almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And at the opposite end of reality, we're likely to have an extremely bumpy October.
The closest number that I've seen to where the House is talking about in either of the numbers that we've just mentioned is just a hair over a trillion.
That's right.
And that's an even bigger gulf between what the Republicans are talking about amongst themselves in the House.
From the Democrats' point of view, majority in the budget committee, the minority in the budget committee, the leadership in the Democratic Party, they do not want to go any deeper on discretionary spending on the domestic side. They're not prepared to cut a deal at the level that the Republicans are talking about for a CR, let alone the more extreme Republicans, a post-sequester CR level. There's just not a meeting of the minds here. This isn't a question of rounding off the numbers, which is the old-fashioned budget deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I give a little, I get a little, I go down from $1.045 trillion to $1.023 trillion, you come up from 988 to 205. We're not going to have that kind of a negotiation. We're not in that atmosphere.
Gordon Adams' third most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. Talks to avert a fiscal crisis in the fall end with no result. Greg Garcia, your third most important federal news story of the week is one that's causing a lot of heartburn in the city. It's from the Washington Post. The headline is U.S. Spy Network's Successes, Failures, and Objectives Detailed in Black Budget Summary. And there are people in this town that have been dying to see these numbers for decades, the numbers that the intelligence community is spending.
Yes, well, it's sort of a spinoff of the Edward Snowden story, I'd say. While I think this is an important story for a number of reasons, but this is among three stories I've picked, a general theme being accountability through transparency. In the next two, I'll be talking about that theme as well. I think we all kind of know in the security community the various capabilities of our government and that vast sums of money are being spent on it. But having this actually detailed sort of spun out in a way that gives a broader sense of what we're trying to accomplish, it sort of causes us to ask, several questions, which is, what is the cost benefit for these great expenditures? And to what extent does the transparency, and the Snowden issue has caused the same number of questions, to what extent does transparency help us improve our intelligence apparatus? To what extent does transparency jeopardize it? And these are the questions we're going to have to balance as a nation, as a government, both members within the government and the security community, and also on the civilian side.
The numbers that are here, the response from the James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, is quoted in the story saying, "Our budgets are classified as they could provide insight for foreign intelligence services to discern our top national priorities, capabilities, and sources and methods that allow us to obtain information to counter threats." He's getting right at the crux of the argument that you're talking about, and that balance between transparency and confidentiality is really, this is the seesaw that we're on with this story, isn't it?
Right, and it's I don't accept that everything that is classified has to be classified. I think there's broad understanding that we overclassify way too much, and to put a blanket over all of these programs as sources and methods, people will lose their lives. It's overstretching that authority. It's overstretching that privilege. And so we do need to take a hard look, try to parse out what is really the most critical security programs. One of the numbers here, which I actually thought might have been larger, $278 million goes to NSA's Corporate Partner Access Program. Essentially, that's working with major companies, whether they are network, ISPs or IT companies making certain products, routers, switches, computers, servers, et cetera, working with those companies and compensating them for the access that NSA needs to get, whether it is through surreptitious surveillance or through some kind of backdoor program in a hardware program. So these, there are companies all over the country who have partnerships with the intelligence community, and we know this. We just don't know exactly what they are. And so it's useful. It's part of this debate. We live in a global economy. We have global companies who have operations all over the world. And to what extent do these partnership programs actually jeopardize their global market share?
Greg Garcia's third most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown is from the Washington Post. USA Spy Network Successes, Failures, and Objectives Detailed in Black Budget Summary. And we'll talk more about this in just a minute as we continue on the Federal News Countdown this week with Greg Garcia and Gordon Adams. Back in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Mobility. Reality Report is brought to you by CDWG.
Cybersecurity protections are expanding at the Defense Department to include new mobile systems. DoD says it's taking a full-on approach to IT protection services and going from just focusing on email and business systems to anything that's connected to the agency's networks. That includes mobile devices, laptops, and even air conditioning and plumbing systems. DoD's Chief Information Officer, Terry Takai, says the official new regulations will be released in October. I'm Sean McCauley.
The mobile workforce. There's no doubt they're mobile, but can they work? If you're in federal IT, that's up to you. Visit cdwg.com/mobility to see how they can keep your people productive and your network secure. Sounds like a win-win. CDWG. People who get it. Visit cdwg.com to learn how SAP Afaria mobile device management solutions optimize operations in today's mobile world.
True innovation means anticipating challenges before they occur. Lockheed Martin was early to recognize the changing nature of naval warfare. New types of threats in coastal waters called for a new kind of combat ship. We responded with deep thinking for shallow waters, designing the littoral combat ship with speed, agility, and the most networked sensors of any surface combatant. And to make sure commanders stay one step ahead of evolving missions, the LCS is built on a flexible C-frame with interchangeable mission modules. It offers the operational flexibility to execute focused missions such as anti-submarine, mine, and surface warfare, providing access and dominance in the coastal battle space like never before. The LCS is one more example of our ongoing commitment to those who are meeting the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
Long, healthy life. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. A study indicates that how many of your remaining years will be healthy as a senior citizen varies according to who you are and where you live. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looked at national health data on the number of years after age 65 that people had good health. The CDC's Beiwei Chen.
Across all of the states, healthy life expectancy was about 14 years on average.
Mississippians averaged the fewest healthy years after they turned 65, and Hawaiians averaged the most. State by state, men consistently averaged fewer years than women. Blacks fairly consistently had fewer healthy years than whites. Healthy living habits, such as not smoking, reduce the odds that people die early. The study was in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Tom and Emily here from the Federal Drive, wishing you a safe and happy Labor Day weekend.
We salute those people working hard for their families and their communities, and especially federal public servants working daily on behalf of our country.
Join us Monday morning starting at 6 for the best of the Federal Drive.
And Tuesday, we'll hear from both sides of the debate over whether federal contractors should have hiring quotas for veterans.
In the meantime, for all the federal news, be sure to check out federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com on this week's Federal News Countdown.
Number 2.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Gordon Adams in a case of great minds think alike. Gordon, your number 2 story is the same as Greg's number 3. It's the Washington Post story on the intelligence community's black budget and the release of it through the Edward Snowden links. And as Greg was talking about the situation with as many things being classified as are and don't need to be, I noticed that you were nodding your head in affirmation quite avidly there. That's a sentiment you share, I suppose.
Absolutely. We overclassify, and we've overclassified in this area, particularly in the budgetary domain. I can remember when I was at OMB back in 1993-94 when Jim Woolsey was the director of Central Intelligence before they'd created the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And Woolsey just fought tooth and nail to avoid disclosing even the aggregate number for what we spend in the National Intelligence Program, the NIP side. There's also the Military Intelligence Program on the non-NIP side. He just did not want any numbers out there at all. And frankly, CIA directors since Yerzat have done that. We're now in a position where that number has actually been disclosed, and now for 5 or 6 years running, we do now have a pretty good tally of what the overall vector has been of intelligence spending. You know, and Woolsey's lost the argument, basically. The directors have lost that argument. This opens a whole new level, and interestingly, it was the argument that Woolsey always made, which was, give them an inch, they'll take a mile, right? So we give them the aggregate, and they're going to say, give us the details. Well, here's the details, mm-hmm. right? And so we've now got 3 years of agency detail, NSA, NRO, NGA, CIA. We now know from this disclosure in some detail these various numbers. I'm going to be interested to see. I haven't seen much reaction from the intel community saying, oh, my God, this is a complete detriment of our national security.
Yeah.
I'm going to be interested to see if there's any reaction at all, any surprise in the least to say, well, okay, CIA spent $14.7 billion. Big deal. The NSA spent $10.6 billion. Big deal. Right? What do we know when you know that? Not too much, because we're not going to get the programmatic details, but you get to begin to get a sense of the size and the variation over time. CIA's up because it's more involved in stuff than it was, particularly on the operational side, and drones and things like that, special ops links and so on. So, and we know all of this because it's all in the papers anyway, right? So it's like no surprise. The whole thing is, to me, almost a yawn. It's a lot of money, but I don't see the threat to our national security in knowing it.
Greg, to Gordon's point, this article quotes Lee Hamilton, who is, I'm sure he's no fan of Snowden or Assange or Manning or any of these other folks that have perpetrated these kinds of leaks, but he didn't seem to have a particularly bad reaction to this. The story quotes him saying, access to budget details will enable an informed public debate on intelligence spending for the first time. I would think if he was really that opposed to it, his first reaction would have been, this is really a bad idea, instead of this is probably a good idea.
Well, Lee Hamilton has always been a thoughtful legislator and a policymaker, and I agree with him. It's one thing to have an informed debate. I think what we also have to have is a thoughtful debate, and the way the Congress has been behaving lately, I'm not sure we're going to have a thoughtful debate about it. But what interests me, and Gordon talked about, you couldn't even see the numbers back in the Woolsey days. When I was at the Department of Homeland Security, and the revelations about Chinese advanced persistent threats, we really, from the White House, it was not an explicit directive, but it was essentially, you can't say China and cyber attack in the same sentence as a government official. So we've come a long way from that point and sort of recognizing the realities of the world we live in, that spying is as old as the oldest profession, as long as there's, curiosity. This is what we do. So the question that I think is that we're going to have to look at, coming from my perspective as a cybersecurity guy, if you look at $4.3 billion, or about 8% of the total intel budget request, is for cyber operations. All the things that NSA and CIA do offensively and defensively in cybersecurity, a lot of that surveillance is digital. It's binary. We're looking at code. We're intercepting code. What the content of the email is not so important when it's talking about a machine attacking a machine. So the issue of Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning is going to have an effect on how we approach our cybersecurity, our cyber surveillance, our cyber offense policies. And that's where I think the informed and thoughtful debate is going to have to take place, and we have to separate out these competing issues.
Gordon, we just have about a minute left, but the number in this story that jumped out at me was 10. Overall, the U.S. government spends 10 times as much on the Defense Department as it does on spy agencies, and I bet there are a lot of people that were surprised to see that think that that's a lot smaller than they probably expected, since we didn't really know that much.
Well, it's actually a pretty expectable number. Most of this funding is included in the Defense Department's budget, so there's an apples and oranges question in the data itself. About 80% of these budgets actually belong to the Defense Department. And I think it'll be interesting to see if this adds much ammunition or fire or content to the debate that Greg's talking about, which I agree is very important. It's the one that Manning and Snowden opened up, which is, you know, what's the right level of transparency? What's the right level of intrusion? What's the right level of policing and control and oversight and accountability in this whole area that's moving so fast and is so large? What I found interesting in the number, the $4.3 billion in cyber operations that's in this data, is that I believe has to be put on top of the $4.7 billion that the government asked for, if you will, white cyber operations, publicly disclosed, knowable budgetary data. That didn't surprise me either, but it really says that our total national investment here is at least in the realm of $9 or $10 billion a year. We still don't have a lot of transparency about what that's all about. I know Greg knows a lot more about it than I know, but there's not a lot of transparency about that to have that debate. So we're still at the edge of what we know and can know sensibly.
Gordon Adams, the second most important story of the week on the Federal News Countdown is from the Washington Post. U.S. spy network successes, failures, and objectives detailed in Black Budget Summary, and you can read it and all of our Countdown stories this week linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Greg Garcia on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Has sequestration and budget cuts made performing vital IT functions difficult for your agency? If so, it's time to explore another option with SUSE Linux, the open source leader. Save time and money by lowering the cost of your operating system and associated products with SUSE's expanded support program. It's the fastest way to save money on your next Linux renewal and lower the cost of licensing without changing any of your applications or systems. Learn more at SUSE.com/spendless. That's SUSE.com/spendless. Or purchase on Soup through CDWG.
DRS is up and running.
Monitoring a border is complex. At DRS, we've deployed technology on the Jordanian border.
DRS is proven.
With desert installations in Egypt, we thrive in the most forbidding terrain.
DRS is ready.
And in Arizona, DRS is ready with the most advanced technology. We're prepared to support the U.S. Customs and Border Protection IFT program. DRS Technologies, up, running, and ready to protect the U.S. border.
Learn more at DRS.com.
Hi, this is Leslie Fenton and
Ellen Sharp.
We're attorneys with Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. Join us this Sunday morning at 10 a.m. for Power of Attorney. We will be talking about negotiating the lease for your company's new office space. Our guest will be Dean Nyman, who is a real estate broker with Trimark Corporation. That's Power of Attorney, Saturdays at 10 a.m. right here on 1500 and 820 a.m.
Long, healthy life. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. A study indicates that how many of your remaining years will be healthy as a senior citizen varies according to who you are and where you live. Researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looked at national health data on the number of years after age 65 that people had good health. The CDC's Beiwei Chen.
Across all of the states, healthy life expectancy was about 14 years on average.
Mississippians averaged the fewest healthy years after they turned 65, and Hawaiians averaged the most. State by state, men consistently averaged fewer years than women. Blacks fairly consistently had fewer healthy years than whites. Healthy living habits, such as not smoking, reduce the odds that people die early. The study was in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Discover how government agencies are currently using data analytics to solve real-world problems at Predictive Analytics World for Government, September 18th and 19th at the Ronald Reagan Building in D.C., featuring case studies, keynotes, workshops, an expo floor, networking, and much more. Don't miss out. Register today and connect with your peers and leading experts at this leading government analytics conference. Register today at pawgov.com. Save 10% when using discount code FEDNEWS.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper says the intelligence community will start releasing annual numbers on the secret court orders
and national security letters that authorize agencies to spy. Clapper says he's following President Barack Obama's directive to declassify as much information as possible. But Clapper says agencies will not disclose details about how they use those documents or who they target. Former National Security Systems Analyst Edward Snowden leaked documents showing the NSA scoops up millions of U.S. emails along with those of terror suspects. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Gordon Adams of American University and the Stimson Center, and Greg Garcia, principal at Garcia Cyber Partners and a member of the Information Security and Privacy Advisory Board. And Greg, your second most important federal news story of the week is from government executive. It's Eric Katz's story, headline, Telling Citizens What Exactly Government Does Would Cost $100 Million. And this is something that a number of members of Congress have wanted to do, is at least find out what all the things are that every agency is doing and use that as a basis for trying to figure out where to cut instead of sequester. What did you see? What part of this jumped out at you? Was it the amount, or was it the way that they came to the number, or what was it?
Yeah, I like the story because it's actually sort of bookended between my number one and Gordon's number three. And I just thought there was a certain irony about it because we're in a budget crisis and we're talking about what are we spending our money on? What is the cost-benefit analysis? Who's going to get the axe? Again, on my theme of accountability through transparency, this is basically is about proposed legislation that would cost $100 million over 5 years, according to the CBO. It's called the Taxpayers' Right to Know Act, sponsored by James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma. Basically requires federal agencies to identify and describe each program they administer, the cost to administer them, the number of program beneficiaries, and the number of both federal and contract staff involved for each service. Transparency does come with a cost, and with cost, and accountability does too. It sort of it gives us the opportunity to put up the wall of shame, so to speak. How can we really justify through the red face test that this particular program really is worth this amount of public expenditures? But the fact that it's going to cost us yet another $100 million to get to that level of transparency, I thought was ironic and amusing.
Was it kind of a here we go again moment, Gordon?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I have to say that I cut my teeth on some of this what does the government do stuff back in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And I can remember Senator William Proxmire, Wisconsin, who every month gave out his Golden Fleece Awards, because he'd reach into the mire of all the activities the federal government does, and he'd find somebody at NIH or NSF or somewhere where they had funded some laughable project and hold it up in the wall of shame, as it were, as Greg is saying. You do have to reach a point in terms of transparency and information where you decide, is what I'm getting so important to what I want to do that it's worth paying the price of finding out about it, right? It's really tough in the department that I know and love best, which is the Defense Department, where they're doing 15 to 20 million contract actions a year. Do you really want to know every single contract action? And if you gathered all that information, which costs you money, as Greg's saying, when you know it, what do you know? Right? What do you do with that information? What do you do differently about that information? And that's just one example. Bob Hale, who's the Pentagon comptroller, estimated in the middle of the summer that the Defense Department employs roughly 700,000 people as individual contractors in all kinds of things, services, contracting, doing jobs, cheek to jowl with a civil servant and what have you. Put those together with the 800,000 civil servants in the Department of Defense, and you got 1.5 million people, ghost civil servants and real civil servants, who are doing work for 1.4 million people in the active duty force. At some level, that's a ludicrous number. Why doesn't Bob Hale know more than roughly 700,000? Because to find out exactly where all of them are, let's say you buy a lawn cutting service for Fort Belvoir, well, you might have 15 people who are services contractors going through doing that lawn cutting service. what do you know when you know there's 15 of them? What you know is you got a contract at the lawn service, and there are 15 people who are counted doing that. So no matter where you turn, we had to deal with this in the 1990s. How far down do you need to know what contractors and subcontractors are to the Defense Department? First tier, second tier, third tier, fourth tier. And when we discovered that you'd spend, like this bill, hundreds of millions of dollars just setting up a bureaucracy to gather and process it, and you're telling contractors, fill out this reporting form, so they're adding five people and putting it on their overhead and billing you, mm-hmm. right? So they're producing this information. What do you know when you know it? Can you use this information? So it's always hard to know how much you're going to get when you dig this.
Yeah, and I, you know, as one who had managed programs and having to deal with the contractor issue, I applaud the sort of the motivation, the inspiration behind this thing.
Absolutely.
But in practice, I remember having to testify before the House Government Reform Committee when I was Assistant Secretary, and this was a time when there were some contractor discrepancies and problems and scandals. And, you know, one of the questions from one of the members was, can you tell me that no contractors had any hand in helping write the testimony that you just gave? I thought, okay, now we are in silly season. If I can't even have a contractor, when at the time the Department of Homeland Security was simply not, did not have enough government FTE personnel to do the work that we needed to do. Of course we had to have contractors, but they were at that point suddenly a black mark.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole process of having to account just for contractors, and the extent to which that was, not pure government work, taking just as a microcosm of the broader question of all the programs and their justification, it will be very hard to do. And most of your time as a government executive will be accounting for that instead of actually doing the work.
Greg Garcia's second most important federal news story of the week on the countdown is from government executive. The headline is telling citizens what exactly government does would cost $100 million. It's linked up, like all of our stories, at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, selected by Gordon Adams and Greg Garcia, next on In Depth with Francis Rose.
At BAE Systems, we work relentlessly to stay ahead of the bad guys. One significant challenge every organization faces is cyber threats. That's why our experts leverage the world's most advanced cyber operations technologies, enabling us to preempt network breaches in minutes, not days. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day. We're there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/next front.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
On Sunday, it's going to be neighborhood restaurant group all the time. The entire show is dedicated to Blue Jacket, Red Apron, Golden Brown Delicious. That means beer, donuts, and fine Italian cuisine. We'll have all the top chefs from neighborhood restaurant group in studio.
That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday at 11 and every Sunday right here on 1500 AM.
The Veterans Affairs Department struggles to fix long-standing cyber vulnerabilities. Members of Congress question whether the personal data of 20 million veterans is being properly protected. And at a recent hearing, lawmakers learned VA's networks were breached several times by nation-states. Federal News Radio explores VA's cyber issues and what's being done to fix the problems in our ongoing special report, VA Cyber Efforts in the Hot Seat. Find it all at federalnewsradio.com. Search VA Cyber.
Now your Federal News Radio DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour. The Navy is reminding sailors to be careful with their drinking during Labor Day weekend. The Navy Alcohol and Drug Prevention Program says crimes related to alcohol can not only affect promotion, but might require forced rehabilitation and reduced career opportunities. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says Labor Day is one of the deadliest holidays of the year for drunk driving cases. Get your DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Greg Garcia and Gordon Adams. And we are up to
number one.
The top of the chart for Gordon Adams is from Defense One. It is James Kitfield's story headlined War with Syria, the Intersection of Interests and Ideology. And this is not strictly a federal government operational type story, Gordon, but it's so pervasive in what people are thinking about and dealing with at two big federal agencies in particular this afternoon.
Oh, yeah. This afternoon, Secretary Kerry gave the government's brief on why it thinks it needs to do something about Syria, and something that is more than what we've been doing so far. And you know that the Defense Department has been winding up all kinds of scenarios, forward deploying ships, checking inventories and stocks, working over target lists, preparing the ground, which is their job, for what may happen here if the president decides he's going to go ahead and attack Syria. The interesting questions, maybe in terms of the federal government perspective here, maybe less is what happens in the Middle East. It may be harmful enough, but does this affect any of the internal stuff that we're worried about? I've had any number of calls in the last few days about if we send cruise missiles into Syria, is that going to affect sequester? Is it going to affect the politics of the defense budget? How much of an impact is it going to have on the defense budget? You know, what's the resonance going to be back in the civil service, in the federal government, in the politics of the budget, which is a lot of what people are asking about. And my view of that is not much, that this is likely to be, as described, and I don't know the details, but as described, a relatively inexpensive episode. If it reaches $100 million, I'll be very shocked, at least as far as I've heard about what's planned. Most of it is firing off munitions that we can choose either to replace or not. We bought the boats, we bought the missiles, we bought the troops. So all of that's bought and paid for. This is the operational incremental cost is relatively small. And it may get us, verge us into Greg's number one story. But, the reality, I think, is that we got a much bigger fish to fry in the federal budget than a firing expedition on Damascus. And that bigger fish to fry is really affected by a politics that isn't too much concerned with what's the impact of this on Damascus, on American foreign policy, or national security.
I would agree with that up to a point, because these things do tend to get they tend to take a life of their own, and we can get drawn into more than we bargained for. If it were just a short term shoot and run, perhaps then the implications for day to day government operations, policy making, might be slight. I hope that's the case. Just at my time at DHS, a hurricane coming through, or some domestic bombing, it tends to, create an intense distraction that takes leadership attention off of some of the many other things that must get done as part of the mission. And this would have, the Syrian situation could have a rippling effect, not just in the budget process, but in congressional thinking about other issues that need to be addressed, many other policy areas. I hope it does not have that kind of impact, but my experience is it will.
Gordon, you and I have talked on a number of occasions about exactly this kind of thing vis-a-vis strategy planning. And this is the kind of thing that if we had even talked about Syria 2 years ago, say, in a frame of reference directed toward the QDR, this probably wouldn't have been something that we expected to deal with, because at that time we were still trying to figure out exactly what the whole Arab Spring thing meant, right, and what Assad's role was, there was a long period of time where we were maybe not fans of his, but content with him being in power. Obviously that's changed, and it kind of goes to the whole point of we don't predict these kinds of things very well.
Right, and that's kind of where Greg left off, and let me just pick up on that point. It was Mark Twain who said prediction is difficult, especially about the future. You really never know when you fire something off what the next step is going to be, and anybody doing good strategic planning tries to reason that through and say, what's going to happen next? What do the Iranians do? What do the Israelis do? What does Hezbollah do? We don't know the answers to those questions. we have precedent for limited strikes. You know, Ronald Reagan did it on Libya, missed Gaddafi as it happened. You know, the Kosovo air war was one of those unpredictable ones. We went in for a week-long exercise and ended up coming out the door about 2.5 months later with a lot more expenditure of munitions and time and money than we thought we were going to encounter. When I was in the administration, we went after the no-fly zones in Iraq, and then when the year after I left, they went after Sudan, supposedly a pharmaceutical factory, and missed Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. So you don't know. There's no reason to expect it to be really bad, worse than we predicted. There's no reason necessarily to expect it to be a nothing burger either. So you don't know. And the parameters are fairly broad, given the uncertainty and disruptive activities in general in the region in the Middle East right now. That band of uncertainty is quite wide, I think. You don't know how people are going to respond. And given the fact that we are not targeting Assad, at least as far as I know, this is not a regime change operation. This is not, you know, the invasion of Iraq or the removal of the Taliban. This is about sending a message. Hardest performance measurement I know is to know whether that message got through and whether 1 or 2 days of cruise missile strikes delivered the message you wanted to have delivered.
Gordon Adams' most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One. The headline is War with Syria, the Intersection of Interests and Ideology, and you can read it linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with all of our countdown stories, including the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Greg Garcia. We'll talk about it next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Report is brought to you by CDWG.
Cybersecurity protections are expanding at the Defense Department to include new mobile systems. DoD says it's taking a full-on approach to IT protection services and going from just focusing on email and business systems to anything that's connected to the agency's networks. That includes mobile devices, laptops, and even air conditioning and plumbing systems. DoD's Chief Information Officer, Terry Takai, says the official new regulations will be released in October. I'm Sean McCauley.
The mobile workforce. There's no doubt they're mobile, but can they work? If you're in federal IT, that's up to you. Visit cdwg.com/mobility to see how they can keep your people productive and your network secure. Sounds like a win-win. CDWG, people who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how Lenovo laptops can provide your mobile workforce with all the tools they need to work on the go.
DRS is up and running.
Monitoring a border is complex. At DRS, we've deployed technology on the Jordanian border.
DRS is proven.
With desert installations in Egypt, we thrive in the most forbidding terrain.
DRS is ready.
And in Arizona, DRS is ready with the most advanced technology. We're prepared to support the U.S. Customs and Border Protection IFT program. DRS Technologies, up, running, and ready to protect the U.S. border.
Learn more at DRS.com.
Discover how government agencies are currently using data analytics to solve real-world problems at Predictive Analytics World for Government, September 18th and 19th at the Ronald Reagan Building in D.C., featuring case studies, keynotes, workshops, an expo floor, networking, and much more. Don't miss out. Register today and connect with your peers and leading experts at this leading government analytics conference. Register today at pawgov.com. Save 10% when using discount code FEDNEWS.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The most important federal news stories of the week, selected by Gordon Adams of American University and the Stimson Center and Greg Garcia of Garcia Cyber Partners on the Federal News Countdown this week. And Greg, your most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. After 6 budget showdowns, big government is mostly unchanged. And this kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier in the program, which is we are where we are, and we don't really appear to be moving off of that despite the best efforts of just about everybody in Washington to make the curve, the budget curve on the government go down.
Yeah, I like this one, I think. where Gordon talked on number three about talks to avert a fiscal crisis, he addressed it appropriately in some really good inside baseball analysis. The Post takes that analysis and generalizes it for a broader audience, and I like that. So people out in the Midwest and California can actually understand a little bit more about what this inertia and dysfunction is all about. Why can't the government get anything done in terms of budget politics? So this is really my number two really talks about how could we bring more accountability to this process where, you know, it says that we're on pace to spend almost $3.5 trillion in this budget. The Post looked at these budget showdowns that you mentioned, analyzed four areas: federal expenditures, the number of federal employees, the number of federal rules, and federal real estate is sort of a reflection of how do we gauge and measure government. The first two, expenditures and employees, those are down slightly over the past few years. Federal rules, way up. Federal real estate, unclear. The federal rules, the Code of Federal Regulations, according to this article, has grown by 16,500 pages under President Obama alone. He's not the only one who's increased that. But I think basically what this article is showing, it's my number one important because it gives the general public an understanding of how budget politics works and enables us to step back and say, what's the cause of these impasses we suffer every year.
Now, your counterpart on the countdown today is very pleased with your selection of this story because he's in here. Gordon, what did you tell Dave Farenthold of the Post about where we stand with this?
Well,
I can read it back to you if you can't find it.
I know what I said. I mean, here's the problem. In budgetary terms, you got two kinds of you got three problems, right? They're very simple. You know, problem number one is have we got enough money to pay for the things that we're going to do? That's a revenue problem. Are taxes high or taxes low? Is enough money coming in? Are the rates right? Are we giving too many tax expenditures away, as they call them, to people who have all kinds of interest and stakes in what the government does through the tax code? Mortgage interest deductions, for example. Nice tax expenditure and very expensive. $70 to $80 billion a year, it's quite a bit, right? Problem number two is discretionary spending. That's the stuff we can actually do something about year by year in the Congress because the Congress votes those dollars every year. And in fact, sequester, that's what it hits. It doesn't hit the revenue side of the equation. And it doesn't hit what I'm going to talk about in a minute, which is the mandatory side of the equation, right? It just hits that choice dollars every year that you get appropriated, what funds. You know, the department Greg used to work for, Homeland Security Department, department I worked with a lot in Defense Department. Those are all basically appropriated dollars every year, discretionary, and we have shoved those down, right? Defense is now on the fourth year of a decline. The domestic discretionary spending hasn't grown, so it's shrinking both the share of GDP and in constant dollars. We've got those things down. The third problem is the mandatories. You know, now there's something really important to understand here, which is, you know, mandatories are the cause of the deficit is the mantra. That's actually wrong. Mandatories do contribute to the deficit, but they're not the major source of the deficit right now. And a major source of the deficit is, in fact, tax cuts of 2001, the recession, which reduced in revenues, so we're over on the revenue side, right? And it is the cost of the war. We basically pumped war costs way up because we had to fight those two wars. Those things have contributed to the deficit and the growth in the debt. What we're looking at in the future is a mandatory issue, you know, because more and more people are going to become eligible for those benefits, and there won't be a revenue stream adequate to come in to fund the benefits that they're going to be provided because they have a right to it. That's why it's called a mandatory. Mm-hmm. You have to spend it. And the only way that you get that under control is by changing the terms of eligibility for those things. And that's why I said here, we're Nowhereville. On that, we have not really gotten to first base. Even Obamacare, which by and large I support, right? Even Obamacare did very little so far to control health care costs. Mm-hmm. That's the issue. It reorganized health care and Medicare. It gave more people access to the Medicare system, more access to insurance. you know, it did all those good things, but it did not grapple with the cost in the Medicare system, and we're not there yet.
You know, my takeaway of this was even a more fundamental human dimension. The conclusion I got out of this is that the politics of the budget are overwhelming for politicians. They can't do it. They can't make the hard decisions. They have folks back home, constituents back home that they have to please, and big companies. Temporary programs become permanent. Hard decisions are perennially put off. The entitlement programs, which are like 60% of the budget, they're untouchable. And many of the programs are duplicative. And so I think, you know, the public reads an article like this and says, well, why do we even have a system where elected officials are the ones actually providing the budget if they can't manage it? Then who do we give it to? For some fundamental questions. Well, the Constitution puts that power right in the hands of the Congress. But
if you want to change the Constitution, we can talk about
that's
that.
That's the kind of questions.
But guess who gets to decide if we change the Constitution?
Yes, of course. There you go.
So let me tell you something. This is why I think a lot of politicians actually like sequester. They complain about it endlessly. Doomsday machine, Armageddon, as we know it, second-rate power, sacrificing kids in Head Start, whatever you're, you know, not enough air traffic controls, whatever you say, screaming and yelling, but the system doesn't change sequester, and it hasn't for 2 years, and I've been really interested as to why. And I think part of the political answer, which is what Greg's getting at, I think, here, is that sequester excuses policy officials from having to make those choices. It says, I don't have to decide anything. The system decides everything. It's like a base closure round for the whole federal budget.
Mm-hmm.
Some god came down, deus ex machina, and made this happen. Can't change it, and I can complain while it happens, but I'm getting the numbers down.
Can blame it all on sequester. Greg Garcia's most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Post. After six budget showdowns, big government mostly unchanged. You can read it and all of our stories on the Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Thank you, Greg Garcia, for being here today.
Pleasure to be here.
It was a lot of fun. And Gordon Adams, same to you, my friend.
Pleasure as always. Thank you.
You can hear this conversation archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.